start. Ah, okay, it's time to start. Thank you. Welcome to the Lightning Talks. First day two. Hopefully we'll be, you guys all know the drill, how this works. But new this year, especially for the presenters, and hopefully it will make it a little bit easier for you in the audience, you don't have to say slide. You have this handy little remote that goes forward and it goes backward. technology, woo! Just so for those of you who haven't attended a Lightning Talk session before, these are almost all 5-minute talks, a couple of 15-minute talks. The presenter has 5 minutes to start. Once they start, I will have a timer going, and they will have 5 minutes to complete their presentation. Presenters will use the clicker to advance their own slides, and they will get a 1-minute verbal warning from me, and they'll get a 30-second warning after that. And when it comes close to 10, we go...
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
okay, wait, hold on a second. I know it's early. I'm tired. I didn't end up leaving the building until 5, and I went to sleep around 9, so you'll please forgive me if I'm a little bit off of my game, but I think we can do a little bit better on the buzzer there. Let's practice going from 3. You guys ready?
3, 2, 1, and...
All right, okay, that's good. Give yourselves a round of applause for that one. And so I myself have a little lightning talk prepared. I think it's handy for me to go first just to take a little bit of the pressure off. This one is going out to everybody who might be attending Congress for the first time. So just wanted to know, are you guys feeling all right? Everything going okay? Perhaps you're not feeling incredibly found. Perhaps you might be feeling a little lonely. Maybe a little bit overwhelmed. Well, you're in luck. And whoa, that slide's actually not supposed to be there. If you've ever wanted to hug me, I will be more than happy to give you a hug. But if you're feeling any of these things, if you're feeling a little lost, lonely, or whatever, there's a new program this year called the Chaos Mentors. And if you feel like you just, it's a little too overwhelming, you don't know what to do, you don't know where to be, you can get a mentor. I will happily sign up to be your mentors. The Chaos Mentors are downstairs, right by the info desk, on your way to the big, big, gigantic assembly halls. Just go ask over at the info desk, where are the Chaos Mentors? Come find us, and we will try to get you set up with a mentor who can help you navigate the Congress and get the most out of the experience. That's where we are. See, Blinky Boxes, Info Desk, Chaos Mentors. We want to help you get the most out of the 30C3, and that's it. That's the end of my presentation. I get a huge round of applause for the people who set this up and the people who are helping mentors out, being Chaos Mentors. Please give them a round of applause. And with that, we have the first talk. Go ahead and take the stage.
Is that a go?
All right, and you ready to go? All good? Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Okay, hello, so I am Emily and this is Baba and we are Hacking with Care. Hacking with Care is a project, a collective project to care for hackers who care and help them care for themselves and others. And before we go any further, we are going to stretch our tongue and face so that speaking will be easier, and I suggest that you do the same with us. So imagine a big lion and stick the tongue out really far. Open your eyes very wide, and let's go. 3, 2, 1. All right, so anytime you have tensions in the jaws, you can do that. It's really nice for teeth grinders, people who grind at night. And it's good before giving a talk. And so now Baba is ready to talk.
Okay, so
hackers by definition have no limits. The only limitation is yet the body. In order to survive, one has to take care of his body and organs. I must say at this point that we do not endorse the post-human clique theory. It's mostly the opposite, like very ancient techniques can provide a solution to very new problems that hackers encounter. Like yoga or traditional Chinese medicine are acts, they are solution to our usual problems, everyday problems. By training, doing a training routine 10 minutes every day, one can feel his own body. And like computers, we can start the day by a boot sequence. You don't need to be a superhero to stretch yourself. Stretching is natural.
Okay, so, and also following that, the way that we see a massage and techniques like yoga, we see them as very successful examples of peer-to-peer. You know, some go back to 33,000 years. And so it's also an example of arts that are free, still free, for in the most part, free knowledge, very open protocols. So in that way, we identify also with hackers' ethics, and this is the way we practice. And so we want to support regeneration of resistance, that the vital forces of people who engage in defense and creation of freedoms feel good and don't burn out doing so. So we want to share what we know about that. And once, I wanted to tell you that also, once before giving a massage to someone, I asked him where he was feeling pain in his body, and he answered that the world is a chronic pain. And in many aspects, it is true. So we want with this project to help you that this pain doesn't embed in your body, and so that we can all do what we have to do for common good without breaking. Right, so
okay, we should
more exercise.
Rapidly some basic exercise that hackers can do. First, the yoga of the eyes, because we are always looking
1 minute
in front of a screen. So the yoga of the eyes is like this. And we train our eyes like this. The second one is for the muscle of the arms, like this. We can do two corners like this, and it helps
stretch the tendons, so the you tendons. Don't get tendinitis from clicking all day.
Another one is for the fingers.
Yeah, warm their fingers.
Okay. We are making a survey, and we would like to invite you to contribute
30 seconds.
Our survey. Okay. To if you know some tricks to help you every day, we'd like to compile this and make a
We want to build a well-being hack box. So
yes.
We have a survey on our blog if you want to contribute with your own tricks.
And
ten,
also, we'd like to invite you on the fourth level with the tea house of the Quadrature du Net, where you can have some massage and some tea.
3, 2, 1.
Hi, mein Name ist Michael Seemann, im Netz kennt man mich als MS Pro. Ich bin seit 2008 auf jeder Freiheit statt Angst Demo gewesen. Ich war bei vielen Aktionen und Petitionen gegen die Vorratsdatenspeicherung und andere Überwachungsformen dabei. Und ich möchte ein bisschen über den Kampf gegen die Überwachung in Zeiten nach Snowden reden. Das ist so das Überwachungshauptnarrativ, kann man sagen, also Anti-Überwachungshauptnarrativ ist: Frei ist nur, wer nicht überwacht wird. Das wird auch mal wieder wiederholt, beispielsweise von Julie C. und anderen Leuten. Ranga Yogeshwar, die sich gerade irgendwie in den Vordergrund dort spielen. Und ich glaube, wir haben damit ein Problem, denn seit Snowden gibt es ein paar Fragen, die wir beantworten müssen. Und zwar Waren wir die letzten 10 Jahre etwa keine freien Menschen und haben wir das nicht bemerkt? Viele Anti-Überwachungsgegner würden jetzt wahrscheinlich tatsächlich sagen, ja, nee, das waren wir auch gar nicht. Wir waren die letzten 10 Jahre keine freien Menschen. Dann könnte jemand darauf reagieren und sagen, haha, hat ja gar nicht wehgetan. Ist Überwachung also gar nicht so schlimm? Die dritte Frage, die sich stellt, und das ist eine ganz konkrete, die den Aktivismus betrifft. Wenn wir eh schon unfrei sind, warum sollen wir denn jetzt noch gegen die Vorratsdatenspeicherung kämpfen, beispielsweise? Ja? Also die Überwachung der NSA ist schon so umfassend, ob ich jetzt noch mehr überwacht werde, das macht mich jetzt auch nicht unfreier. Ich würde sagen, dass ein Bit Überwachungsmeme, das heißt also überwacht oder nicht überwacht, gleich unfrei frei, dieses ein Bit Überwachungsmeme ist kaputt. Und ich wollte ein paar Thesen aufstellen, wie man das vielleicht reparieren kann oder wie man dort vielleicht wieder zu einem besseren Narrativ kommen kann, um gegen Überwachung zu kämpfen. Und das Erste ist erstmal anzuerkennen, dass es unterschiedliche Qualitäten von Überwachung gibt. Dass es eben nicht einfach eine Überwachung gibt und eine Nicht-Überwachung und dann ist alles, dann haben wir die Welt erklärt. Ich glaube, so ist das nicht. Und zu den unterschiedlichen Qualitäten eben die Thesen. Die erste wäre, Überwachung ist nicht gleich Macht, sondern Macht macht Beobachtung zur Überwachung. Also beispielsweise, wenn ein Anwohner die Straße beobachtet, dann ist es eine Beobachtung. Wenn ein Polizist das Gleiche tut, dann ist es eine Überwachung. Warum ist es das so? Weil Macht hat, wer die Möglichkeit zur Disziplinierung hat. Das heißt, ich brauche schon mal erstmal ein Strafregime, eine Androhung von Sanktionen, damit die Beobachtung überhaupt zu einer Überwachung wird. Und dieses Strafregime ist, glaube ich, das zentrale Thema eigentlich bei der Überwachung, dass eigentlich, wir konzentrieren uns bei dem Überwachungsdiskurs immer nur auf die Beobachtung selber, aber eigentlich müssten wir uns viel mehr auf das Strafregime konzentrieren, denn es ist viel schlimmer als und viel entscheidender als beispielsweise die Verletzung der Privatsphäre oder etwas ähnliches. Ich meine, Trojanow, der Anti-Überwachungsaktivist, der in die USA nicht einreisen konnte, der wurde nicht wegen bestimmten Informationen und seiner Privatsphäre nicht in die USA einreisen gelassen, sondern wegen seinen öffentlichen Positionen. Das hat überhaupt gar nichts mit Privatsphäre zu tun, aber das Strafregime war da und die Disziplinierungsmaßnahme war da und deswegen ist auch dort die Überwachung schlimm, wo sie eben nicht die Privatsphäre betrifft. Und ich glaube, wenn man diese Thesen so ein bisschen verinnerlicht, dann kann man davon ein Überwachungsranking, also eine unterschiedliche Qualitäten von Überwachung durchaus anerkennen. Ich habe das jetzt mal aus deutscher Sicht aufgedröselt. BND ist schlimmer als die NSA. Die Überwachung vom BND ist schlimmer als die NSA. Warum? Weil der BND eine deutsche Behörde ist und er mich deswegen sehr viel mehr betrifft. Das Strafregime ist sehr viel konkreter von dem BND als von der NSA. Der Verfassungsschutz ist wiederum schlimmer als der BND, weil der BND eigentlich gar nicht für mich zuständig ist, ein Auslandsgeheimdienst. Und der Verfassungsschutz hat tatsächlich die Aufgabe, mich zu überwachen, also im Zweifel. Das dritte wäre, Vorratsdatenspeicherung ist schlimmer als der Verfassungsschutz, denn die Vorratsdatenspeicherung bietet unglaublich vielen Strafregimen bis hin zur Polizei eine ganze Messlatte von Sanktionen, die gegen mich ausgesprochen werden können. Diese und viele andere Thesen will ich jetzt demnächst zusammenstellen in einem Buch und das wird heißen Das neue Spiel, wo ich versuche eben solche neuen Regeln und solche neuen Parameter für eine Freiheit im Internet nach Snowden aufzuschreiben. Dankeschön.
Okay. I screwed up on 2 accounts. I apologize for that. The first account is in order to help the video angels record the lightning talks and actually say at what time points certain talks are happening and provide keywords and things like that, they've set up this system for all of you in the audience to use. Can you guys see the URL from here on the screen? Is it too... It's not note, it's 30c3.shownot.es. You guys everybody got that? Okay. 30c3.shownot.es. That will take you here, and then the Lightning Talks link for day two right there. And if you're really fast, you might have your message appear on the screen right there. The Signal Angel automatically has an account enabled on the system. So if you could help at each Lightning Talk, if you obviously people, you might know that the schedule for the Lightning Talks is right here available on the wiki, which is fortunately running. Can you get a round of applause to the people who got that back up last night? And the second thing to announce is, for those of you whose English isn't that great, we are translating all of the Lightning Talks live, overdecked, into German. And I think that's really awesome. Can we get a round of applause for those guys? The number that you call is the same for getting German talks translated into English. And without that, I'm sorry I took up your time. We're running a little bit behind. And is this correct? Nope. Which talk was it?
Snake.
Oh, Snake. Is secure email storage here? Nope. Guess not. All right. Good. And you got the clicker?
Yep.
Okay. Awesome. And go.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm Alessandro, and today I'm here to talk about Snake. Snake is an online private social network which offers to their users end-to-end encrypted communications. Why do we need it? Well, you know. If you've attended the talk of yesterday of Glenn Greenwald, you know more than enough to understand why this is needed. So here's the architecture. We have a central server, which is here modeled as a single server, but can actually be a federated network of storage, and a series of different kind of clients. We can have a mobile client application, which can be downloaded from Marketplace, or it can be used as a simple web page. The storage server is very dumb. It does nothing. It just stores and serves encrypted data. And we consider it an adversary for now. So let's see how it works. Everything is done on the client. The client encrypts and decrypts all the data before leaving the browser, and when it comes back, it decrypts it. It's completely written in HTML5 and JavaScript. This means that we can port it on almost all platforms really easily. And most importantly, it's free software. Isn't JavaScript cryptography in JavaScript bad? No, not necessarily, because we are using the Web Crypto API, which is an emerging standard by W3C, which allows you basically to use the underlying cryptographic primitive of your web browser, which means you're using actually OpenSSL or Mozilla's libNSS or Microsoft Crypto API. We took EV inspiration from OpenPGP, because simply it works. The problem with OpenPGP is how do you do authenticate public keys? It's required to meet in person someone you want to communicate with and do what we call the key signing party. This does not scale well, and it's not easy to use for the average user. This was public key authentication the problem. In alternative, you can use the Web of Trust, which allows you to exploit the authentication made by the other users to authenticate public keys. The problem with the Web of Trust, here we have an image, it's that you can label it. It's completely public. So if you use PGP properly, you're actually revealing most of your friendships. And we didn't like this. For this reason, we used another method for direct public key authentication, which is based on the Socialist Millionaire Protocol, which is used also by OTR. And basically, using an implicitly pre-shared secret through a question and answer, whose answer should be known only to the two ends of the communication, we are able to authenticate public keys without revealing anything about this secret. And it's not possible to brute force the answer to this question, because each verification requires interaction from the other end. In alternative, we also offer a Web of Trust, which does not leak any information about friendship, because in Snake, in practice, you consult the list of friends of your friends looking for the public key of your friends. And these lists are private, are not public, so there's nothing public here. And we sacrifice the possibility to do multi-step authentication, but it's better than losing your privacy. The third problem is the scalability of communication in PGP, because when you send a message to someone, you have to attach a version of the symmetry key used to encrypt the message for each recipient. And this does not scale really well. In Snake, we just use a single key for group communication. And if you have to add a new member to a group, you have to send it all the key, a copy of the key you use for all the past messages, which is M, and this is not scalable. Instead, we don't have this problem in Snake. It's really scalable for group communication. If you want to remove a member, this is not a problem of PGP, but we handle in a really scalable way in Snake because it's logarithmic. Okay, last problem is the exposure of metadata. If you use PGP, when you send an email, the recipient of the message and the sender is public. In practice, in Snake, we suppress all the metadata. So if you look at the database, you can understand who is the sender, who is the recipient, of if two users are friends. In this case, we have to trust the storage server, but it's still useful in case of Caesar. So in conclusion, we have a new social network, and in future we want to create a real-time chat, a secure file sharing of it, and a collaborative online office suite, the first one end-to-end encrypted. Please support us. We have launched a crowdfunding campaign. You can find all information at snake.li. Please visit the website and contribute. And you can find more information at the You Broke the Internet Assembly. Thanks.
All right, so the 1 o'clock lightning talk was a little bit late. Are you good?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay, so should we allow it? Should we let him give his talk even though it was a little late?
Thank you.
Okay. Just so you know, you missed this announcement. There is actually a clicker on stage, so you should be able to advance your own slides.
That's cool. Okay.
Okay. Go.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, I'm Dominic. I'm talking about secure email storage with a GPG plugin. The typical email system layout you can see here, you have an SMTP server, you have some back-end storage system, for example, MySQL, a file system, a Berkeley DB, and you have an EMAP or POP3 emails server, for example, Cyrus, Perdition, or Courier, and you're connecting with any of your devices to this email system. Well, the biggest problem is that your email is saved unencrypted on the backends. So the typical encrypted email system is that you have here a symmetric key, which the email provider is encrypting your emails and storing it onto his hard disk. The biggest problem there is that it's one symmetric key, and any agency can force him to open it and to decrypt your email. So I'm using Kupi SMTP. It's an SMTP daemon you can just put in front of any other SMTP daemon. And it's mostly doing very interesting stuff. For example, it is easily extensible. You can write your own plugins with in Perl. It has very good spam and virus anti-measures. And it has backends for QMail, PostFix, XM, and just any other SMTP daemon. You can even put it in front of Exchange. So to get it going, to get very good encryption in the back end, you have to use some asymmetric encryption scheme, for example, RSA or DSA or anything else. And so I'm using Kupi SMTP in front of an SMTP daemon. The Kupi SMTP is forwarding the email with SMTP to the backend SMTP daemon. In my case, it's a PostFix server. And I've extended an existing backend queuing plugin to encrypt it with GPG. So any email which is coming into the system is encrypted with a recipient's PGP key, and so no one can enforce the email provider to to give them your private key before, because it's your private key and not the private key of the email provider. The QPS MTP plugin is written in Perl, well, because it's QPS MTP is written in Perl. It uses a normal open new PGP tools to encrypt every incoming email. It is using the PGP MIME standard, not the inline standard. And it's using the recipient's PGP key, which must be locally available on the email server, but only your public key, not the private key. And the private key, the public key must be trusted on the email server, so it is used to encrypt the email and stored in the backend. The advantages of this method is that you can use any standard email client which can use PGP to read and write your emails. For example, under in Linux, you can use Evolution or ClauseMail. Under Android, you can use Add2 Mail to read your emails. It's working very fine. I'm doing that. And even if your email to your email account is sniffed, still nobody can read your emails. That's a very important feature. And the decryption key is only available to you. To
1 minute.
Security is not dependent on any third party, so the email provider cannot open it to the public. The drawbacks are server-side searches in the body are not possible, and the recipients and subjects are still visible to any who get access to the email account. So the QPS MTP daemon can be used to get some kind of secure email storage. It's available under this small blog post. It's available under this URL.
30 seconds.
It's inspired by some other blog post you can find here. And if you want to help improve this plugin, you can just write me an email and can give you access to my JIT repository. Thank you.
Okay, just two more things that I forgot to mention. But now I have Club Mate, so I should be a little bit more on my game. First thing is, especially for speakers, when you approach the podium, be sure to adjust your microphone so that you can hear it. If you absolutely need to stand far away from the podium, we have a portable mic here, so you can hold a mic in one hand, clicker in another, and people can actually hear you. Because there's this funny thing that happens when you get further and further away from a microphone. People tend not to hear you.
What did you say?
And then when you get closer and closer and closer to the microphone, people in the audience can hear you, and it's especially important for the people who are watching the streams at home. But fortunately, we have a really, really awesome team of audio angels. Can we get them a round of applause for making me look good? And making everything work. So let's practice. Let's get the microphone pointed closer to your mouth. You can actually move it down a little bit.
Hello?
Yep. Okay. Yeah. All right. Are you good?
Yep.
Okay. All right. Don't forget. Don't stand too far away from it.
Is it okay?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
That's fine.
All right. Whenever you're ready.
Okay. So hello everyone. My name is Sylvia, and I would like to talk to you about online footprinting. So there has been a lot of talking, I mean, regarding intelligence gathering and mass surveillance and private data analysis. But one thing that I would like to point out is that there is a simple fact about the web nowadays. And this is that the web is kind of inherently built to log, to track, to record, and to control what we do with it. So this means actually that data and documents on the web are linked together. And it is possible and kind of simple to construct semantic connection between data on the web. So this was a snippet of Snowden's first interview. And there is one point about this interview that when I listened the first time, I happened to disagree with Snowden. And it was the fact that we have mass surveillance without even the need for an NSA to spy on us, because what we do is we are constantly producing data on which we have no control. We use our phone, and our phone connects to the mobile network, and while we move, it connects to each base station that the mobile network has installed. So if this was not enough also, we produce rich data that have a lot of context and are publicly available, and that's just because the packets that we produce travel across the network and travel through every node, but we just give data away. So once I asked a friend, because she was using Foursquare a lot, and I asked, why are you checking in every place you go? And why you also check in if you go at home or if you go to a bar with friends and you talk people? And she said, well, I think it's useful to my friends to know where I go and which place I like. And I think I have nothing to hide. So I thought of a simple experiment. I went on Twitter, I used the API, and I collect 300 tweets of a user. And then I displayed those tweets with the locations and the days of the week. So I found out that actually this person, in the last, I don't know, months or 3 weeks probably, has been a lot in Rome, especially in the weekends, has traveled to Milan, has traveled to London during the week. So I can make simple assumption on the fact that this person maybe is creating data that are linked between each other, and maybe I know something about the life of this person that I couldn't just realize without looking at a tweet. So this is kind of like a puzzle that I can build piece by piece. And considering also that we are wearing like biometrical devices that are, for example, monitoring our sleep patterns, or the car that we drive is telling us if there is a pizza place that we would like to visit because we have half an hour free before our meeting, or that we are living in smart cities that have sensors in every place we go, I realized that we generate an incredible amount of data, and this data is linked between each other, and it's really revealing a lot about our identities, but we have not a clear idea what our identities actually are at the moment. We're just giving the data away, and we are literally losing control on what we give away. Thank you.
Okay? Okay. Cool. Ich bin nicht Klaus Wallenstein, auch wenn es da steht. Ich musste kurzfristig einspringen, weil er erkrankt ist. Ich versuche den Vortrag so gut wie möglich rüberzubringen. Es geht um das Web 3.0, Rückeroberung der Freiheit im Internet, eine soziale Bewegung. Okay. Okay. Begriffserklärung Web 3.0 vor Snowden. Wenn man bei Cisco in den Charts nachliest, ist das ein semantisches Web mit künstlicher Intelligenz, totale Überwachung als Geschäftsmodell. Verschmelzung kapitalistischer und polizeistaatlicher Interessen, Datenschutz und Datensicherheit, race to the bottom, also niedrigster Standard, und das Internet der Dinge mit möglichst vielen angeschlossenen Geräten. Nach Snowden wissen wir brauchen ein gehärtetes Internet, wir brauchen sichere private Kommunikation als Individualrecht, wir brauchen demokratische Kontrolle der Geheimdienste, international verbindliche Rechtsrahmen für Unternehmen, wir brauchen ein Internet des Citoyens, das heißt ein Internet der Bürgerinnen und Bürger. Das sollten eigentlich Ziele einer sozialen Bewegung sein. Was ist eine soziale Bewegung? Wir brauchen einen kollektiven Akteur, wir brauchen unterschiedliche Organisationsformen, Graswurzelbewegungen, Parteien, Gewerkschaften und so weiter, unterschiedliche Mobilisierungs- und Handlungsstrategien, ziviler Ungehorsam, Reden mit Parteien und öffentlichen Akteuren. Das Ziel soll sein, entweder einen gesellschaftlichen Wandel zu beschleunigen, zu verhindern oder umzukehren. Beispiele sozialer Bewegungen sind Frauenbewegung, Arbeiterbewegung, Bürgerrechtsbewegung, Anti-Atom-Bewegung, leider auch der Faschismus. Antriebskräfte sozialer Bewegungen sind gesellschaftlicher Missstand, der konkret fassbar und erlebbar ist. Persönlichkeiten, die für die Bewegung einstehen und vor allen Dingen Verstärkung durch die Medien, wie hier in den Bildern, die ich da gezeigt habe. Resonanz in breiter Öffentlichkeit ist dringend notwendig, um eine soziale Bewegung ins Rollen zu bekommen. Das Handlungsschema am Beispiel des Vietnamkrieges. Es gibt eine gesellschaftliche Veränderung aufgrund der Empörung der Kriegshandlungen. Die veränderte Gesellschaft übte Druck auf die Politik aus. Die Politik musste auf Druck der Gesellschaft irgendwann handeln und die Entscheidungen der Politik flossen zurück in die Gesellschaft. Dadurch gab es Regierungswechsel, eine liberale Gesellschaft, die 68er-Bewegung. Handlungsschema beim Web 3.0. Es ist ein bedeutendes neues Handlungsfeld, müssen wir integrieren. Das sind technische Lösungen, haben beim Vietnamkrieg in dem Aspekt gefehlt. Weder die Aktivitäten der Handlungsfelder noch die Wechselwirkungen sind im Moment gleichgewichtig. Handlungsschema ist wesentlich komplexer dadurch, dass wir technische Lösungen integrieren müssen. Die Veränderungen sind wesentlich schwerer herbeizuführen. Ein langer Atem ist erforderlich. Das Handlungsschema sieht im Moment so aus. Wir haben technische Lösungen, die im Wesentlichen gesellschaftliche Veränderungen determinieren. Die politischen Entscheidungen sind nahezu vollständig von den technischen Lösungen getrieben. Es gibt keine Rückwirkung auf technischen Lösungen. Sie werden nicht kontrolliert. Die gesellschaftlichen Veränderungen wirken auf die politischen Entscheidungen, aber wir erleben nicht, dass politische Entscheidungen zu gesellschaftlichen Änderungen führen. Die Technik ist im Moment der große Antriebsmotor. Alles, was technisch machbar ist, ist auch technisch möglich. Größte Dynamik ist im Moment zwischen der Gesellschaft und der Technik. Das, was die Gesellschaft fordert, wird von der Technik geliefert. Was die Technik zur Verfügung stellt, wird von der Gesellschaft aufgesogen. Der Druck auf die Politik von Technik und Gesellschaft verpufft scheinbar wirkungslos. Wir sehen nicht, dass da überhaupt irgendetwas passiert. Handlungsfelder sind nicht mehr ausreichend verzahnt. Und das Endresultat, was wir im Moment sehen, ist ein Netz ohne Regeln. Was wollen wir eigentlich mit einer sozialen Bewegung? Wir wollen ein Web 3.0, wie ich es gerade definiert habe, und zwar ein gehärtetes Internet. Wir können die Verantwortlichen sogar benennen, die dafür zuständig sind, dass sie das im Moment nicht haben. Das sind Politik, Geheimdienste, Internetkonzerne, die dagegen arbeiten. Wir haben alle Möglichkeiten einer offenen und freien und demokratischen Gesellschaft. Die Leute, die gegen den Vietnamkrieg gekämpft haben, hatten es da wesentlich schwieriger und haben es trotzdem geschafft. Aber im Moment scheint es keinen Moment der Veränderung zu geben. Was fehlt? Die Bewegung hat scheinbar keine gesellschaftlich übergreifende Identifikationsfigur. Ströbele hat seinen Wirkungshorizont längst überschritten. Die Bewegung hat eigentlich kein Sprachrohr. Snowden sitzt in Moskau und ist damit dem Diskurs entzogen. Videobilder reichen nicht aus. Die Bewegung kann die Bedrohung nicht greifbar machen. Nur Systemadministratoren haben emotionale Gefühle, wenn sie Serverräume sehen. Was noch viel schlimmer ist, wir haben eine gesellschaftliche Dysfunktionalität. Das heißt, die Leute, die gegen das Web 3.0, das gehärtete Internet kämpfen, CDU und SPD, werden bei Wahlen bevorzugt. Die Parteien, die für ein Web 3.0 kämpfen, die werden bestraft. Es steht kein Druck auf die Regierung. Es ist wieder eine Zeit, den alten Thoreau an den Tag zu holen, und zwar den Pflicht zum Ungehorsam gegen den Staat. Und was ganz wichtig ist, Technik ist keine Lösung, das verstehen Techniker, Ingenieure und Wissenschaftler schwer. Nur Politik ist keine Lösung, ist schwer für Politiker zu begreifen. Und Verhaltensänderung ist keine Option, da die Menschen den Nutzern der Verhaltensänderung im Moment nicht erkennen. Was wichtig ist, ist, dass wir das dysfunktionale System entzahnen und technische Lösungen, gesellschaftliche Veränderung und politische Entscheidungen wieder ins Gleichgewicht bringen, um eine gesellschaftliche Veränderung herbeizuführen. Und erste Lösungsschritte werden, wir müssen die Gefahren begreifbar machen, wir müssen selber als Bewegung sichtbarer werden, wir müssen rausgehen aus dem Serverraum und in den öffentlichen Diskurs rein und wir müssen störend werden. Wir wissen, wo wir hingehen müssen, wir wissen, wer dafür verantwortlich ist und da müssen wir ansetzen. Und wenn es für diesen Kongress kein Motto gibt, dann weiß ich eins, freies Internet durchsetzen, Web 3.0.
And one more quick note for the speakers, this is in all of the rooms, what is on the projector is in a screen, two screens right down here. Can you see the screen from the podium? Okay, so that you don't have to go like this and then again get out of the range of your microphone. So you've got your clicker,
yep.
You're all ready to go?
Yeah, it works.
Okay, go.
Okay, good morning, I'm Eric, I'm a member of the CCC in Mainz, I work for an IT security company and since a few months I have a website again. What this talk is about, when doing black box penetration tests, the first step, what you need to do is to find out what you're dealing with, what kind of application you are attacking on the web server. So this is about fingerprinting, I guess you all know it from TCP fingerprinting and similar stuff. For Java web application, it's quite easy to trigger some kind of stack trace in most cases by inserting null bytes into the GET request, inserting null bytes into XML data, or cost timeouts of any sorts. Every now and then, it's also possible to query the Google cache for a website, see if there are stack traces stored. I guess most of you have seen such a stack trace. This is a reduced one, so it fits on the slide. Basically, each line is a function call, and it tells you where this function call happens, on what line, and what is called is on the line above. From the simple stack trace you have seen from the reduced one, you can gather that the server used Tomcat in version 6.0.36 and Java GDK in one of those versions. How is it done? Since we know on what line another function is called, and since we can create a database which contains where each function resides, we can simply use the data from the stack trace to see for which version is this true. So what have I done? I've downloaded several frameworks, several Java applications, unzip them, use a nice Apache library to extract the data from the class files, dumped it all into MySQL, and have written a simple PHP front end to retrieve the data from there. It's not nice, but it works. Right now, those are the projects which are already in the database. As you can guess, it's quite some data, so it's not that fast. So bear with the server if you try it. So far, there's no capture, just use it. I'm not logging anything besides usual Apache logs, so if it works for you, I'm happy to hear about it. If it doesn't work, drop me a note so I can add a framework which is maybe missing. Yeah, that's it. So if you have any questions, I'm around.
Investor to state dispute settlement?
Yes.
Oh, okay, great. Don't forget, you've got the screen down there, you've got the clicker, you'll adjust the microphone, and also, if you have not received your 1 minute warning, you will have time for questions. And if you guys in the audience really, really want to try, think you can get a question in, please go to one of the four microphones that are out in the aisles, just in case the speaker has time for questions. But once a Lightning Talk speaker receives their 1 minute warning, we do not have time for questions and we're going to move on. So thank you for that interruption. And whenever you're ready, take it away.
Yes. Welcome everyone. I'm Ante Wessels. I'm involved with Vrijschrift and the Foundation for Free Information Infrastructure. I will give a short talk about investor-state dispute settlement, or ISDS. Why is ISDS important? Investor-state dispute settlement gives multinationals the right to sue states before special tribunals if changes in law may lead to lower profits than expected. Multinationals can challenge reform of copyright and patent law, challenge environmental and health policies. Oh, this is the slide. How does the ISDS system work? International trade and investment agreements give foreign investors greater rights than local companies. Even expected future profits are protected. On top of that, foreign investors do not have to use a local court system. Arbitration tribunals consisting of three investment lawyers decide the cases. These tribunals can overturn decisions of our Supreme Courts. Let me give three examples. After the nuclear disaster in Japan, the German government decided to close down two nuclear reactors. The Swedish company Vattenfall now claims 3.7 billion euro using investor-to-state dispute settlement. My second example. Australia introduced health warnings on tobacco packaging. Tobacco company Philip Morris claimed that their trademarks lost value and sued Australia in local courts. Philip Morris lost the court case and then started an ISDS arbitration case. My third example, Canada made some minor adjustments to its patent system to assert better access to medicine. United States pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly now claims $500 million in ISDS arbitration. The ISDS tribunals can overturn decisions of Supreme Courts. ISDS is best understood as a transfer of sovereignty. It gives investors equal standing to states, and it gives investment lawyers the power to decide in conflicts between investors and states. Investors and investment lawyers are natural allies. So in conflicts between investors and states, the natural allies of investors take the decisions. The system is fundamentally flawed. There's no excuse for ISDS. Jovita Stiglitz, Nobel laureate in economic sciences, point out that investors can take an insurance if they do not trust a foreign legal system. He also explains what is really behind ISDS. The real goal is to restrict government's ability to regulate and tax corporations. And regarding the process, Stiglitz notes, corporations are attempting to achieve by stealth through secretly negotiated trade agreements what they could not obtain in an open political process. ISDS threatens our ability to reform copyright and patent law, to protect our privacy, to protect our health and environment. Vital interests are at stake. What can we do? Consumer and environmental groups already did a lot of work. The European Parliament is critical about ISDS. The digital community can help to tip the scale. Next year, there will be elections for the European Parliament. I suggest we try to keep proponents of investor-to-state dispute settlement out of the Parliament. Thank you.
Haskell database?
Oh, okay.
Yep, if you're ready, go ahead.
Okay. Good. So Haskell is a lazy functional language. It has a very strong static type system. And to paraphrase the old saying, those that do not like static type systems probably didn't see Haskell's type system. So I'm also a Python user, so that's a big difference compared to dynamic languages. It also has a very advanced compiler, rule-based optimizations, and so. Protein databank is a column-based format that contains most of macromolecular data that has been discovered using crystallography and other experimental methods now. It's over 10 gigabytes, and frequently the analysis can need to run over the whole database quickly and be iteratively improved until the dependencies are found. Using a new parser, we can do it in 15 minutes, basically, on quad-core machine. Here is an example of the benchmarks. Basically, it's faster than BioRabi, BioPython. That's not so much a surprise. It's also faster than BioJava, that uses two threads for parsing. And it's competitive with C-based parsers of PyMol, RasMol. In parallel version, it uses just 1.5 seconds of processor time on four threads compared to 3 or 4 seconds of other solutions. We just used some built-in compiler optimization and map pre-allocated arrays. Of course, byte strings to avoid copying the strings. So I would say that these are the standard techniques used, for example, in GNU grep or currently used XML parsers. I also would like to use the opportunity to encourage everybody who knows Haskell to join BioHaskell project that already involves the libraries for biological sequence parsing, genetic sequence parsing, RNA secondary structure, and structural data. Please let me know if you have any questions.
Okay, quick reminder, refresher. If you are giving a lightning talk, please, we invite you to sit in one of the many seats in the front row so that you don't have a nice little bit of aesthetics that you have to do before coming up to the podium. Also, those of you who are standing on either side of the room, we have plenty of seats over here. I don't even need to ask people to raise their hands. Don't forget, adjust your microphone before you get on stage, and make sure you're not talking too far away from it.
Sure.
Okay. And all of your slides are down here, or they're even over here if you like, so that you don't have to look at the screen. It's the same thing on both screens. You have the clicker in your hand?
I do.
You do? Everybody's been getting the clicker. That's. I'm really happy about that. So, yeah, let's do a round of applause for that. Screw it. All right, and your 5 minutes starts now.
Hi. What's a book scanner? A book scanner in every hackerspace. Nice dream. It's a machine to scan books from the public domain or not. To keep them for the future and to share with friends, family, and the internet. And to allow anybody to read books we once loved before. And to spread the knowledge and stop creating a world of proprietary culture and ideas. Okay, what's this book scanner? It's a machine invented by Dan Reed, thanks to the awesome guys at the DIYbookscanner.org forum and community. It's a free software and free hardware machine that anyone can and should build in your hack center. It's the dream of Dan to put a book scanner in every hackerspace in the US, and I personally added in the EU too. And it's a cool hacker machine, you will see it, looking like some futuristic something-ish Darth Vader style. Okay, how does it work? It's protecting the book by not opening more than 90 degrees and scanning it thanks to two photo cameras, a cheap Canon one, usually 16 megapixels. And we hacked them with CHDK, the Canon Hacker Development Kit, to allow us to do everything automatically through the USB bus, shooting, transfer, focal distance, and so on. And it's also a web application to manage the book scanning process, to industrialize the book scanning process. Okay, which software are we using for this? CHDK that I talked about before, the firmware add-on for Canon cameras. It's also PTPCam, a command line tool to drive the camera from Linux. It's also PHP, Apache, and Linux for the small web-based project manager and industrialization process. And two software that we couldn't do without it, ScanTailor, that I really recommend. You should not don't use it when you scan, please do use it, to rotate the picture and enhance the picture and automatically deskew and enhance the black and white things, so that the last software, Tesseract, that I really recommend, both of them, which is the free software-based OCR, can do the optical character recognition and obtain a nice EPUB. Okay, which communities is there in the DIY book scanner? Mostly people serving books on the internet, like archive.org, that you certainly heard of, the Wayback Machine. They also scan books, and they have a big fire in their place, so support them. Also to Project Gutenberg, you know her, you know them. They are guys who also provide public domain books for everybody to read, and Wikisource, which is doing the same thing, almost. And of course, the DIYbookscanner.org community that I really recommend if you want to start a book scanning project. There is a lot of people there, ask them, they will be nice to you. Okay, what now? Come and scan your books. The book scanner is currently at the third floor near Salle 2, behind the second big room, near La Quadrature du Net Tea House. So come, have a tea, and ask for a book scanning if you got books you like and you love here with you, or ask for a demonstration if you want to see the machine and learn how to do it and build your own. And when you go back home, build your own scanner so that everybody in your location can do it. And also industrialize the scan. A machine which doesn't work, which doesn't serve, is weeping, is crying. And what's more disturbing than a weeping book scanner? Well, so thank you very much. Come at the second floor and see you then.
Okay, so slides are down there. You adjusted the microphone. You've got the clicker in your hand, I presume?
Yes.
Ready to go?
Need it.
Yep. Yeah. Go.
Absolutely.
5 minutes is yours.
Okay, thanks. Hello, I'm Yana, and this is Vasil, and we are from Bulgaria. And today we want to share with you how in the past few months we organized 5 deaf conferences in different Bulgarian cities. The main reason to do this was there was a conference gap between the capital of Bulgaria and the smaller cities. Almost everything was happening in the capital. Just in a few words, what you need to organize a traveling conference is not as much as you might think. At the beginning, you will need one very enthusiastic coordinator. In our case, that was me. A core team of around 10 devoted helpers and speakers. A local community, in our case, usually it was the local hackerspace to help us organize things locally. A simple project management tool, a common structure for all the conferences, and that was 2 or 3 local speakers usually, 5 traveling speakers, and the organization of lunch and coffee breaks and after parties. The thing that wasn't clear at the beginning was the budgeting and financing. So at the beginning, we didn't want to have any sponsors because we wanted to be independent. The first conference was financed by the core team. All the conferences were low budget and it costed between 400 and 500 euro. And the next conferences after the first one were financed by the donations we gathered during the events and sales of mostly pre-ordered t-shirts. You can see one here and one here. The nice thing was that all the t-shirts were different, so at some point people started collecting them and following the conferences in different towns. At the end, there was a conference with a profit of approximately 3 euro. How we chose the venues, we really used the locals to do this. So we used universities, sometimes hotel conference halls, and in one town we used an old cinema. We announced the conferences through the local IT communities, social media, traditional media sometimes, and in our personal blogs. And it was really useful. It was empowering for the local communities. We've met and hopefully inspired a lot of new people. Some people adopted the conference model and organized their own similar events. They understood it wasn't so hard to organize events. In the end, it was fun. We had lunch together as a casual introduction. We had after parties, of course, after the conference. We had after parties on the beach, wherever a beach was available. Sometimes we had after parties. Pictures are not available. And also, as I mentioned before, we had groupies, people following us around the country. Vasil will tell you more about the technical side of the organization of those events.
That was actually the easiest part of the conference. So the main point here is that everyone can do this. We have our
One
equipment
minute.
Was mostly a camera, a few microphones, a laptop to record this and to stream this. And our setup takes about an hour to do if you are very, very lazy. Otherwise, it can be faster. The whole thing, we even did a workshop on how you can do this technical setup for everything, and the workshop took an hour. And that was it. I was wondering what else to say half the time. So everyone can do this, everyone can set this up, and it's actually very fun. And then
seconds.
You can leave a lot for the next conference, for the people to see, to have recordings of what you did, for other people to see it, and for the people who couldn't attend, just to be able to see the streaming. And there's just one thing. These are our contacts, but the only important thing here was that keep backup equipment. That was the only one. Thank you.
Thanks.
wrong slide. Here. Am I ready to go?
Yes, you are. 5 minutes starts now.
So welcome to my little talk about Kinko. During the last day, I heard a lot of the big talks and many were about encryption is very important. We have to protect ourselves. But there is a problem. Email encryption is still too difficult for main spread adoption. There is a too big hurdle to take, even to install the tools and everything, and to start encrypting your email. And Kinko is here to solve this. So we believe that email encryption, that email content belongs to the sender and receiver only. We believe that email should be encrypted. We believe that email encryption must be easy to use, and we are here to build such tools. What is Kinko? Kinko is basically an easy-to-use, accessible, secure PGP proxy. Easy to use, it takes email encryption out of the client, making things easier. You don't have to take care of encryption yourself. Why is it accessible? Because you can use it with any device and anywhere you are. And why is it secure? We use PGP, combination of PGP, open source cryptography. All the emails rest on an encrypted file system on your own hardware, which is hopefully safe in your home. And if that's not enough, you can put the box in your doghouse. why do we do it? What is special about Kinko? Three things. First, you can keep your favorite email client. You don't have to get a special email client that can do PGP encryption or anything. Just if you use Thunderbird, MUT, whatever, you can keep using it. Because Kinko acts as a proxy. You do not have to trust anybody. You don't have to trust any cloud service or anything. You have everything on your own hardware, for example, in a little box in your home. And you remain in full control of everything. The key is yours, everything is yours, you have full control, and yeah, that's, I think, very cool. How do we do it? Well, saying that it acts as a proxy basically explains it. You configure your email client to use Kinko instead of your email provider. So the email is sent to Kinko. Kinko encrypts the email with the receiver's public key, forwards it to your email provider, then it's passed on, and the same thing can happen on the other side. Of course, the other person doesn't need to use Kinko as well. They can use, for example, Thunderbird and Enigmail or anything else to do the encryption. The idea is to make things easier, to give people who are afraid to, who want to encrypt their emails, but who are afraid of the technology, a tool that takes care of encryption for them. How do we do it? We're not claiming to do things better than anyone else. Or in other words, we're not reinventing the wheel. So what we're doing is we're combining proven and trusted free and open source technology and give them a new and exciting purpose. Since those tools were originally not intended for a proxy application, we of course have to do a little modification, some patches, our own front end for the configuration and a custom SMTP server. And the idea to make things as easy as possible, we try to put everything on a little box. Think of a single board computer like the Raspberry Pi. Again, it will run on almost any hardware, but the idea is that you have some, for example, some political group, like I think the next talk is from Amnesty, maybe Amnesty International political group, and you can give them this little box. They will plug it in their home network, and then they can start talking to each other with encrypted emails. So, yeah. So to set all up, we provided a little interface, a little web interface that with that you can access the box, or Kinko, which also looks really, really cool. And yeah, that's basically it. So for since on this lightning talk, there's not much time for question and answers, we've set up a little IRC channel that you can see here, where me and my team will be ready for answers. You can, of course, come to me directly and ask me. Also, I have these really cool info cards about the project with an early access code that you can get. I will remain here in the room until the break. So if you want, listen to the other lightning talks until seconds. The break, and then you can get the cards or talk to me. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
All right, Amnesty International. Okay.
Right.
All good? Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Hello, everybody. 5 minutes, very short, so I'm going to quickly read this statement. First of all, thank you for the Kinko presentation. I think we should talk about that. My talk is entitled Take Action on Digital Human Rights, and I'm here to call upon you to get involved in our work or to cooperate with us with Digital at Amnesty. A freshly set up task force within the German section of Amnesty International. Many here at the Congress have approached us and they wondered why Amnesty hadn't taken the stage on digital rights earlier. I can't answer this question here, but I can say that here we are, and we are finally ready to take the challenge. I registered this lightning talk because I'll give a lecture on Monday, the 30th of December, entitled Human Rights and Technology, A New Hope, or The Empire Strikes Back. And I would like to promote this talk today because it had been placed very much at the end of the Congress, and I didn't want to see everybody leave the scene before I even had the chance to say hello to you guys. Also, I wanted to approach as many people as possible because I think the topic of my talk will indeed be one that needs the attention of many. It's not so much because I think it's also interesting, which I believe it is, but because it's going to be mainly about cooperation and a better networking among political activists, and networking above all needs people. What exactly will I be talking about? My talk will be split into two main parts. The first one will give you an overview of human rights issues in a digital world with a clear focus on the Snowden revelations. And I think this might be of interest to many of you here who know a hell of a lot about IT, how to use them and how to build them. And so you feel very well prepared to combat the NSA's attack on our private lives through technical means, which has already been and will be the subject of many talks here at this Congress. But probably not as many as you might know about the legal and the political implications of the revelations made by Edward Snowden. And I'll try to give you, as said, as time permits, a brief overview of actions that politicians, professionals, and NGOs around the world have taken to counter this war on privacy on a political level. And most prominently, this will also cover a human rights claim that Amnesty International has brought forward before the British Investigatory Powers Tribunal just a few weeks ago. The second part of my talk will focus on what every single one of us can do about this situation of human rights in the digital age. And this is going to be about the role of civil society, about how you can take action so as to make a difference, and about what I think is needed in order for the human rights movement to be able to cope with the challenges that the ever faster development of technology poses for the exercise of human rights of every individual. And I think a very important aspect in this regard is cooperation. We are certainly the newbies in this subject, but we quickly noticed that there are many NGOs out there active in this field, and we all have a lot in common in terms of the goals that we pursue. But if we are to succeed, if we are to win this battle over our personal data, over our personal lives, and indeed over our personalities, then we really need to join our forces. And we need to do it now, because as we've seen in the course of the last months, other forces have been acting fervently and very cooperatively indeed about killing our privacy, and with it, our identity. And we need to stop them. So once again, I hope you join us on our talk on Monday 1:45 p.m. in Hall 6, and on our subsequent workshop as a self-organized session at our Amnesty Assembly at the Noisy Square. Or just have a chit-chat anytime with one of our activists at the Noisy Square. We'll be there for you throughout the whole Congress. So come over and let us have a deep talk about our chances to act jointly, because if there's one rule that will decide on how we will live our lives in the future, then it will be this.
30 seconds.
He who has the power, he who has the data has the power. So any uncontrolled big data application will be an instrument of empowerment for those who apply it, and an instrument of enslavement for those who are affected by it. We need to stop these neo-feudalistic tendencies early this time. Thank you.
Okay, and I just wanted to say I owe an apology to Big Alex. I was supposed to set up something that would help manage our time a little bit better, but as I said,
you do later.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry about that. But you're good?
Yeah, okay, I'm ready.
Okay, and you can work the clicker and everything else like that?
Beg your pardon?
Oh, you can work the clicker?
Yeah. Oh. This one and this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Hello?
Go.
My time starts.
Oh, adjust your microphone up a little bit.
Okay. Hello? Okay. Right.
Go ahead.
I'm Big Alex from Chaos Computer Club Dresden, and I'm here to invite you to join us in a light painting session this evening. For this, I brought this light painting tool, and it's quite obvious how it works. I will do a short demo now. And if you brought a camera with you, just take it out, set it to an exposure time about 3 to 6 seconds, and so I will just take a quick walk from here to there, and I think you will figure out for yourself how it works. And if you're ready, on three. Okay, thank you very much. You can turn the light on now. So if you have any images that look good, you could send it to Nick Farr, for instance, or there's a USB stick, or we have enough images here. Of course, this is I'm not the first one to come up with this idea. So the credits for the concept goes to the mechatronics guy from Australia, I think he is. And he built the first light guide, and he was inspired by a project from Norway, Immaterials, where people painted Wi-Fi networks using light painting. So I just adapted the hardware a bit he built. And how does it work? It's quite simple, actually. You have a QB board here. You could also use a Raspberry Pi. It would work as well. You get a LED stripe you can control. You have some power pack, and you have some buttons to trigger it. And furthermore, you have a Wi-Fi access point, which is not active at the moment because the knock would kill me, I think, for using a Wi-Fi access point in this hall. And that's the reason why I developed new software. What I wanted to do is to provide more control in the field. If you're here at the lake, you don't want to fiddle with your laptop and prepare images and so on. So basically, what you can do is you have connect to the Wi-Fi access point with your mobile phone. You have a web interface where you can enter your walking speed, how fast you want to walk, and you can select your image. You can do minor corrections to the image. And you have powerful on-device image pre-processing, so you just have to prepare a normal GIF or JPEG or PNG image and put it on the device, on the SD card, and all the image preparation for output is done on the device according to the parameters you can enter in the web interface. So let's play tonight. If you like, come to the outside and the main entrance area and bring your cameras and your tripods. And of course, I want you to bring your own images. So if you can send them to me until 7 p.m. this evening, I will put them on the device and have them ready for you. So we have everything set up. You can use normal JPEG images or PNG images, but with a PNG you have to remove the alpha channel, so else they won't work. And so you can find the URL of the self-organized session in the wiki if you want to join, and also my email address where you can contact me, or you can contact me in the break now. It's no problem. And last but not least, big thanks to all the people who helped me with taking the picture, or at least who took the amazing pictures. I'm not a photographer. I'm just like to build things and hack with things. And so I need their help, and it was a good cooperation. So big thanks
1 minute.
To Christian for taking most of these amazing images here in front of the CCH, and to a colleague of mine, Martin, who helped me also with experimenting with this device. Thank you very much.
All right, we are going to take a 10-minute break at this time, and if the Bitford demo folk would come up so they can get their laptop set up, that's great. We will meet you back here in 10 minutes. Thank you. Okay, great. Hey, nice to meet you. Is your friend's presentation on your laptop? Okay. Okay. All right. If it fails, then it comes out of the time. Okay. Okay. Yeah. He doesn't. Okay. Yeah. Also, I didn't.
So, then you can...
We're on break right now. Yeah. No, I don't think it's down there. It might, who knows what the hell it might be. Oh, okay. So they know to switch back here. Okay, good, that got updated. So yeah, these guys have the only 15-minute talk. Everybody else is 5 minutes. I think you have everybody else's slides. 14:25, 30, 14:35, 40, 45. And then the other guys don't have slides, and I'll be back for my laptop by then. Oh, wait, shit. 14:45. Yeah, 14:50, so I should be back by then.
Get sick.
Okay. Check, check. All right. Wonderful ladies, gentlemen, and hackers of all parts of the planet. We are approaching the end of our break, so if I could have you guys take your seats. Is your video ready to go? Okay. If we could get the podium video up on the beamer. While the video guys scramble for that, just so that you guys know, my very, very good friend is giving a talk in another room, and he has asked me to be present to assist him. So I have the wonderful Lovesley Gedzik here, who will be taking over for the latter half of the lightning talks. Could you give him a huge round of applause for helping me out and for doing that? So I will see you in about 45 minutes, and we have our first 15-minute lightning talk, which actually is two lightning talks. They are running their own display hardware. So are you've got the 15 minutes up?
I got the 15 minutes.
Okay, so now hopefully all their display hardware will work, but if it doesn't, you will see why. We preload all of our slides, and without any further ado, Astro, go ahead, take it away.
Hi. So I hope we all learned a couple of things this year, like do not trust centralized structures. Well, we already knew that. Another thing that was very important for me is usability. We need to fetch the users from where they are. And where are the users? They all have the browser in front of them. So combining these two things, we need JavaScript supported peer-to-peer in the browser. And this is now in 2013 getting possible. And before I pass over to Faro with a more generic approach, I want to show you what I did with a little demonstration. And I am always concerned that the internet will turn into TV 2.0. So I want to show that video on the web can be peer-to-peer. It can be really social. And what systems are out there that are already widespread, of course, that is BitTorrent. And the Chrome or Chromium browser nowadays allows you to install so-called packaged apps, which works just like extensions, but they've got a different set of privileges. They don't get to snoop in your web pages that you've got opened in your tabs, but they can do TCP and UDP networking, and it's just what I need. So without any further ado, let's get to the demo. First, we need a torrent file. We don't need to go to some currently illegitimate website. We can just go to bitlove.org, which is an entirely legal system. If you know any podcasters, tell them to sign up. It's just one time only, and then it's fully automatic from there on. So now we just download a torrent meta-info file. It's very small, of course. And now we'll load that into our app, which is called Bitford. And there it is. All right, and if it's working out, it's working. It gets some peers, so it's not downloading from one server, but from many, many peers. And what's going on here is, like a lot of other BitTorrent clients, it selects the pieces to download randomly. So even distribution is achieved. But what I'm doing here is when data comes, is being received, I immediately check the hashes so that it's valid, and that allows me to quickly deliver it to any consumer. And so I can immediately press play. And if it's working out, it should start in a couple of seconds. Yes, it's starting about now. And this is video from a torrent file streamed to the local machine. And because the browser tells me what data it is interested in, I can also seek to arbitrary positions. All right, that is basically it. I've got a few links for you before I pass over to Faro. My code is the first URL, then there's a JS torrent, which is quite a similar approach as a Chrome packaged app, but there's also a very new approach of doing this with WebRTC, which doesn't only work in Chrome packaged apps, but in ordinary web pages. And if you're If you're having trouble creating torrent files, I made a little tool for that too. It's called Hashimi. It works entirely in the browser, and you can just quickly create a torrent file. And it is for Bitford.
So, hi everybody. What Astro said was exactly right. We need secure applications that are usable, and it is usable when it's in a browser. That's the case. Everybody has a browser. And so what we built is a encrypted peer-to-peer video chat platform for the web. So there's a web page called https://palava.tv, and what you can do is go on there. You can join a room, and then you have a video chat just like in Google Hangout or in Skype, but in a free and open source peer-to-peer and encrypted way. And I want to talk about that for a few minutes. What we are basing on is a new web standard called WebRTC, which is now available in the newest versions of Firefox, Chrome, and Opera, also on the mobile devices. We can do with WebRTC peer-to-peer connections between browsers. That's the first time that we can have peer-to-peer on the web, which is a pretty cool thing. And WebRTC also standardizes to do things like audio and video streams on top of that. But you can also do raw data if you want to, which is allows you to do arbitrary things with peer-to-peer on the web. WebRTC is built of some components that are new in the browser. You can get access to the webcam and the microphone by the get user media function, a JavaScript API function. You can do peer connections to other peers, and you can do on top video and audio already, raw data, as I said. That is for the get user media really easy. If you have a current version of Chrome or Firefox, this is the Chrome version. You can see it because of the WebKit prefix. You can call get user media. You can say, I want to have access to either the camera or the microphone or both. And then you can give the function a callback, which gives you back a stream. And the stream can be attached to an HTML5 video element, which is a very easy way to get your own camera on the screen. For peer-to-peer connections, that's unfortunately a little bit more difficult. You need a little server part, which is a little bit like a tracker in BitTorrent. You do some initializations over that server. For example, you exchange via SDP, which is also part of other voice over IP protocols, string which contains all the information about which video codecs you're using, which kind of streaming you're wishing, which bit rates are fine for you, and which encryption you'd like to use. There's by default only perfect forward secrecy encryption, so that's a pretty cool thing, which was the result of the last IETF meeting after the NSA affair. And you have to do, unfortunately, in times of IPv4 netraversal, and this is also something that needs to be taken care of. And there are still some interoperability problems and workarounds that you have to do for the working of Firefox and Chrome together. So we did that, all of that, and we released a whole software stack to do that as free software, free and open source software, under the terms of the GPL. And we have the Palava machine, which is kind of the tracker in the BitTorrent world, which is a room server, so everybody who's in the same room can talk to each other and get a connection to each other. But the video and audio content and everything that you send is not sent over the server, it's sent peer-to-peer, so we don't ever get any content. we have the Palava client, which is kind of a jQuery for WebRTC for video applications. So this is really easy to use. You just take it and integrate it in your own project. And we have also released our portal that we use for our Palava instance, which is only one Palava instance of hopefully many in the future. So we have one instance running, but everybody of you could run your own instance. We have tutorials for that. You can go there, you can chat with people. There's no registration, you just start to chat. And we have the signaling server part and the student part, which is the natural version. So the server parts you can use if you want ours. Or you can set up your own. It's all open source. We are a non-profit organization since October with 13 members. You could help us by hacking on it. It's all open source. We have the code on GitHub, github.com/palavatv. We have a tutorial step-by-step how to set it up on a Ubuntu, and we will have one how to set it up on a Raspberry Pi soon. We have a GIST, I don't know, 20-line example how to use our Palava client library if you want to do own projects, like if you want in any web project integrate something with audio or video, just look in there how it works, yeah. And the server parts, either you use ours, we have it completely open, it's not shut down, you can work with it, or you can host your own. How can you help in other fashions? We need people who think, yeah, that's a cool project. We need strong encrypted, nice privacy-enhanced communication platforms. You can help us by coding and designing. There will also be an appeal for funds in January if you want to spend some money. And the best thing you can do for us is spreading the word, Twittering or blogging. Try it out. Use it with your friends. It's a cooler thing than Skype, I think. Get in contact with us. We have a blog. We have a newsletter that you can subscribe on the Palava website. You can send us emails. I'm here for the next few days. So if you want to have a chat, I'm willing to drink a mate or a beer with everybody who wants to talk about peer-to-peer. That's my credentials here. And Jan and I, two of the founders, are doing signaling hosting, signaling IO. So if you're interested in that, you can visit that page. Thank you.
Okay, that so went pretty well for all the setups.
That is the page.
Oh, you want to show some more?
I could, but my Wi-Fi is pretty broken, so I'm not quite sure.
You still have 2 minutes. Okay.
So I can see myself, but at the moment, no the other. Yeah, but you try it out. It's online, and you can host your own if you want.
Okay, thank you. Then we'll go on with the next talk, which is going to be Screen Invader. Can I have the video back on this presentation notebook? Thanks. Okay, then you may start.
Hi, my name is Amir. I'm a crazy hacker from Vienna. Thank you. I'm a crazy hacker from Vienna, and I'm a member of the MetaLab. Right now, I want to introduce you to the Screen Invader, a social TV. At the MetaLab lounge, we are often sitting side by side, surfing the web, and when we discover something, we want to share it. Showing what you found to your neighbor is easy. You just turn your laptop over and say, "Have a look," but when you are not sitting side by side or you want to show content to several people, things easily get uncomfortable. The Screen Invader was created.
Thank you.
something went wrong.
So,
oh, that's half the slides, but okay.
I'm sorry, I don't have anything else here.
Okay. Things get as easily uncomfortable. The Screen Invader was created because we wanted to share. So what can the Screen Invader do? You can send videos, images, and GIF animations and PDFs to the Screen Invader, and many users can control it at the same time. And you can manage the playlist, and you can also stream content directly from your laptop or your smartphone to the Screen Invader. Sounds familiar? Yes, it is very similar to the Chromecast, but it was released 2 years earlier, and it's completely open source, and it has nothing to do with Google. And so how does it work? The Screen Invader is a Linux distribution. Just write the Screen Invader installer image to a USB stick, insert it into an old x86 or PC or laptop, and hook that up to a TV or projector. Connect to the web interface and install either the browser plugin or a bookmarklet, and then just surf the web as you usually do, and when you see something you want to share, click the bookmarklet and it will be shared. If it is a video, it gets queued on the playlist, everything else will be displayed immediately. You don't need to install any additional software. The Screen Reader is completely cross-platform, and in fact it is... Okay, now to the technical details. The Screen Invader is based on Debian. It has its own bootstrapping tools and installer, and it uses Janosch, which is another tool I wrote, which is also pretty cool. Check it out. Janosch is a JSON document database. At the moment, only x86 architecture is supported, but I'm working on porting it to one of those HDMI sticks, in fact, the MK8022. And so it's going to be available for ARM. And now I've got a little quiz for you. Who can guess in what programming language Screen Invader is written? Come on, guess. Yeah, shell script. It's entirely written in shell script. So it is very obscure, but it is very easy to hack and a lot of fun. So, and now, oh, I forgot it there. And now, everyone who wants to try the Screen Invader can get a pre-installed USB stick from me. Just insert it and boot and you will have a Screen Invader. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on with the next talk. Kitten Groomer. Okay, I guess we'll just wait until he has distributed all his USB sticks. And they are almost gone. Now, the last one is called for, so we can start the talk. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, all. I will present you today a small tool I'm developing called Kitten Groomer. It's a USB sanitizer. Why is this name? Because USB are full of dirty, dirty kitten, and we want to clean them up. Okay, thank you. So, bit of context. We all exchange USB keys all the time with friends, with family. Also that. So, it's... So, I think of USB keys, but anyway. And they're a major vector of infection. So, it would be nice to have a way to make sure that you do not infect your computer with USB keys you get from somewhere, untrusted sources. And as they're black boxes, well, you don't have any way to know what is going on with USB keys before you plug it in your computer. So it would be nice to have a way to fix this problem. And you cannot really rely on antiviruses because they will not catch all the malwares. And if it's a targeted attack, it will never be catched automatically. So
for example, you are a politician in a foreign country, or you are visiting a company somewhere, and you, or you are just working in the university, and you get a USB key from somewhere, or you just want to share your to get your work for to work on at home, and the computer of the university is infected by something, and you don't want to have it on your own. You find a USB key in the street, it might also happen, and you should probably... Okay. So, better like that? Okay. So you just want to have a look at a USB key you get from somewhere you don't know who it is and you don't know what is in it, but you still want to have a look at it more safely. What do we want to fix? We don't want to rely on antiviruses because we cannot trust them by default. So we will assume that all the files are malicious or might be malicious. We don't want to guess anything in the documents because if it's a touch attack or if it's some kind of zero day or new ways to bypass your protections, it's better to not do any kind of guessings. So we'll just use MIME type of the file and do or treat all the same files the same way. We want to have a safe environment because, well, we don't want to have to open documents in computer connected to the internet. So air-gapped and no critical information on it. So it's definitely better that you don't have anything that is you don't want to share with anyone else on the device you use to clean up your USB keys. Portable, because as you are probably traveling, you don't want to carry a whole computer, a whole air-gapped computer that will only be used to that for that with you all the time. So I use a Raspberry Pi for that. Easy to use, because if it's not easy to use, we all know that if it's a security device is hard to use, it will not be used anyway. So it has to be easy. And off-the-shelf standard device, because if you are traveling somewhere in a country you don't really, and you have to cross the border, it's better if the device doesn't look too suspicious. So how does it work? You just plug the USB keys. So it's the normal version, use a Raspberry Pi. So you have two USB ports. If you never saw a Raspberry Pi, I can show you one later on. It's just two USB ports. You have SD card. You install the system on the SD card. And you plug the USB keys. So in the first on the top slot, you will plug the USB keys you get from somewhere. On the second slot, you will plug the USB an empty USB key, bigger and trusted, so your own USB key. And the content of the first one will be copied on the second one. What does it do exactly? So all the Windows executables are renamed. So if you have something .exe, it will be renamed with dangerous at the beginning and at the end. So this way, it will not be able, you will not be able to just run it on Windows. All the documents that LibreOffice can open, so all the text files, all the Office documents, so LibreOffice or Windows, Microsoft Office, will be converted in PDF and then in HTML. All the PDF are converted to HTML. Archive are extracted.
1 minute.
And the content is processed. And all the documents are just copied. And when it's running, you just have a bunch of MIDI files running, so we'll have some nice sound. And you probably don't want to listen to it all the time. And everything is open source, so you can just get it on my GitHub account and open new issues. You can get a pre-built image on the website, too.
30 seconds.
Yeah. And just flash it. But if you want to do your own kit and groomer, just use the open source, the source code. And there's a tutorial with a bunch of pictures on the website, too. Thank you very much, and I will be around.
Okay, thank you very much. Next up is Chaos Translation.
Is this okay?
Yeah. Okay, go on.
Yes, my name is Helga. Hello, I'm presenting and representing a small project based in Southeast Germany. It's called Chaos Translation, as said. Our agenda is to translate the book Chaos, Dieci anni di hacking e mediativismo into German language. You've probably seen the cover or heard of Autistici Inventati, short AI, which is a tech collective from Italy, funded more than 10 years ago from two branches, one more technical, the hacker branch from Milan, and the other one more activist. And they are also supposed to be here at the Congress. I don't know, is anybody in the room? No. But anyway, when the book was published, it was clear that it's must read for me, and I thought how cool would it be to not just read it, but really translate it and then share the translation. And so I gathered a crowd of people with different interests and also with different resources in terms of skills and motivation and time, and we did a rough estimate that if one person full-time needs 2 months, then if we are five and have two hours per week, then we can make it in 1 year, and that seemed like a reasonable goal. Already now it's taking longer than that, and it's clear that we have to seek a compromise between speed and perfection and our resources, and we also need more support. So how are we working? Yes. First, we will use the usual online collaboration stuff, mailing list, wiki, and chat. Then we also meet in real world and hold translation fests. And as a third piece, we use the translation platform GlotPress, was originally used for WordPress translation, and we modified it a little bit. This is how it looks. And it is not intended for whole books for the translation, and indeed it has some drawbacks if you use it like that, but in general it was quite easy. We extracted the text from the PDF, then split it into paragraphs and converted it into translation files. And one special thing is that we maintained the page number for reference in the paper version. And yes, in case you want to join, what do we need? First of all, we need more persons to translate. They should be German native speakers with medium knowledge of Italian. It's not so difficult because the texts are mainly interviews. It's casual language and it's a very heterogeneous style. It's no literature. And for validation and copy editing, also German native speakers are preferred, but Italian is not so necessary. Layout, distribution, print, that's not yet on the agenda because we are at 50%, a little bit more than 50% translated. But if we really will print it, maybe, then we also will do some crowdfunding for the printing. And yes, if you're interested in the project, the results, or want to contribute, then contact us.
Okay, thank you. Next talk, why is anything the way it is?
Hello. Hi, my name is Srinivas, and I'm going to spend the next 5 minutes asking this very, very obvious question. I'm a PhD student and I was trained as a physicist. So why is anything the way it is? So if physicists have been asking this question for a very long time, and we know why some physical things are the way they are, because we ask this question and we figure stuff out. We know, for example, why airplane wings have a certain shape, because we understand Bernoulli's principle. We know why wires are made of copper, most wires, because we understand conductivity in metals. So in these examples, we first understood the science, then some guys, maybe 50 years later, went around building stuff, and then we have cars, we have planes, we have computers. So most of these objects that we have came this way, where first the science came, then new devices, new machines, and new systems. But there are many systems in our society that were not built this way, but they were built the other way around. Sometimes they were constructed first, they grew organically. And then when we tried to understand how they worked, we try to use science to figure out what they do, how they work, how we can change them, but we haven't made any progress. And for these systems, if you ask why are the things the way they are, it's not so an obvious question. So in this sense, many of our critical systems were not designed like we designed cars or computers. Our political systems aren't this way because they are the optimal method of collective decision making and problem solving. Mostly they're just accidents of history. our economic systems are not this way because we know that our present levels of wealth distribution, employment, or budgetary decisions are optimal or even rational. We know that they're far from that. So if you ask why is a car designed this way, you will never get into trouble. But if you ask why the economy is this way, you will get into trouble. And I'm reminded of this quote by Helder Camara, who said, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. But if I ask why they are poor, whoops, they call me a communist. So we think we like to think that we live in an intellectually free society, but in fact, there are some questions that we cannot ask, or we're not allowed to ask. We're allowed to take some limited action that you will think will change the status quo, but if you question why the status quo is the way it is, then you will be called revolutionary. Since 2008, we have been in a global stagnation of the world's financial and economic systems, together with an unprecedented move of wealth from the poor to the rich. But we still don't understand why it happened and what we can do to prevent it from happening again. So you heard yesterday in one of the talks that one of the reasons why states monitor and measure their citizens and their land and their states is because they want to solve the problem of how to control us and how to get us to do what they want us to do. Similarly, we cannot solve our problems, whether they're mechanical problems as to why your car doesn't work, or your economic or your political or social problems, if you don't know what's going on. You have to know what's going on. If you don't understand how a machine works, you cannot fix it when it's broken. Sometimes we cannot even tell when it's broken, and we do things that actually make the problem much worse. Some of you might have heard Jake Applebaum and others urging you to use power for good, to do something to make the world suck a little less. That is true, but it's very hard to debug code when you don't understand the language it's written in.
1 minute.
Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer, postulated in his Foundation series that someday we will develop a science of how social systems work, and then in doing so, we can make our life better and control how our societies evolve. There's no reason why you and I can't figure out how economic and political systems work. There's no reason why we can't design these systems to work better and to fix systematic bugs in these systems.
30 seconds.
In many ways, these systems are the biggest, most complicated machines we've ever built, and they are too important to be managed by economists or politicians. Thank you.
Okay, next talk starts now.
So, hello everyone. I think we have a little issue here because I think this is not my latest slide set, but so we have to manage it somehow. So, I'm here to invite you to participate in the GNU naming system, the GNS Key Exchange Party we have here at the 30C3. Perhaps some of you already heard about the GNU naming system. The GNU naming system is a new name system for the internet. It is designed to be fully decentralized, censorship resistant, and you cannot only use it for mapping IP addresses to services, but also for mapping names to GPG keys or X509 certificates. So it's a very generic approach, so you can have mappings for every value you want. So it's completely decentralized and is based on the idea of a pet name system. And so every user manages it his own namespace, so he has only local names. So every user is completely in the possession of every name in his namespace, and to allow people to resolve each other's names, each user can publish these names in a peer-to-peer network, in a DHT. So, and here we have the challenge. To resolve each other's names, people have to know each other. So, if we have a user Alice, Alice maintains her own namespace where she can manage her records. And we have a user, Bob. Bob also manages his records. And so they have to get to know each other and exchange some information how to resolve their names. And so we have thought about a very convenient way how to do that. So when they get to know each other, they don't exchange their phone numbers, but instead they exchange these fancy business cards with a QR code on it. And this QR code contains the required GNS information to resolve each other's names. So we thought the 30C3 is a great place to exchange this information. So we thought about having a key exchange party here. I prepared some slides with the required steps, but yeah, they are missing here. So the basic required steps are you have to install GNUnet in the latest version. Then you have to set up your records, but this is optional, so only if you have records. Then you can create these fancy business cards. You can even get a printout if you go with your PDF file to the Vau Holland Foundation. They can make printouts. And then you can use these business cards to exchange it with your buddies. Your buddies can use their webcam, so we have a tool for that, to scan these codes. And then their information is automatically added to their GNS namespace. OK. All these informations are on our website. So if you're interested, just go to https://gnunet.org, and one of the first links will contain the information about the key exchange and all the installation requirements and everything you have to do. So at this point, you just should remember to go to gnunet.org and check out the latest information. So. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Okay, I think there's one more talk announced that doesn't have slides. Is that correct? Is anyone here who still wants to talk? Otherwise, we're done for today. Nick should have been back by now, but he probably got lost somewhere. So you will have to deal with me now. We are basically done with the Lightning Talks shift for now. And all I can say is now the usual stuff.